Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Columbus Storytellers Project event, Growing Up. We're going to get started. It's so nice to see all of you. We really appreciate you coming out and taking a chance on this live storytelling event and sharing your evening with us. It means so much to us for you all to be here to create community in this way. I'm Danae King, and I'm a reporter with the Columbus Dispatch. I'm the coordinator of the Columbus Storytellers Project, and I'm also one of your co-hosts tonight. The Columbus Storytellers Project is part of the Columbus Dispatch, and our local journalists have been working with people from the community to help them tell the true personal stories that you're all about to hear tonight. But first, I'd like to introduce our acting editor, Kelly Lecker.
Good evening. I'm so excited that so many of you came out to hear these storytellers. This storytelling project's really special to the newsroom because we got into this business for a lot of reasons, but one thing we all have in common is we love to hear stories and we love to tell stories. And we in the newsroom believe that the more stories you tell, the better the public understands each other. You know, you might hear someone tell their story and you think, I don't really have all that much in common with them. But when you really start to listen, little details will resonate with you. You know, maybe they're talking about a food they ate as a child, and that's something you remember. Maybe they're talking about a difficult relationship they have with their sibling, and that's something you can relate to. And the more these details you hear, the more you realize that we're not really all that different. And we start to build common ground. And how great is common ground in these divisive times? So that's our goal here. I had the pleasure of listening to a rehearsal last week of this event, and I'll tell you a few things. You're probably going to laugh along with some of the storytellers. You might cry, and you will definitely be inspired. So I'm going to hand this back over to Danae, but thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Kelly. I'd also like to thank our host tonight, the Columbus Athenaeum, for having this beautiful twinkly light venue here with the stage. So thank you so much to the venue. And, you know, we're here tonight to experience the art of live storytelling. And we'd like you to think about what we're going to do as a visit with a close friend. So we encourage you, as you sit here tonight, to open your hearts and minds like you would during a visit with a friend. None of these tellers are professional. They've all come here tonight without notes to tell their stories to you from their hearts. Some of them will be polished and professional. Some will be casual and conversational. Some will be breezy and funny. And others will touch on complicated themes within our community. We ask you to receive them all. And we hope you walk away understanding a little bit about somebody else's experience. So tonight's theme is growing up, and we hope you feel energized, inspired, and maybe a little bit nostalgic as we share these stories with you. Before we get started, I'm going to welcome my co-host and colleague, Amelia Robinson, up here.
Well, hello, Columbus. Look at you out there. You're looking good, people. I am so happy to be at this beautiful venue looking at all your beautiful faces. And if you're sitting next to somebody who is pretty, or if you're pretty yourself, I just want you to give you or them or me a round of applause for being here tonight. Like Danae said, I'm Amelia Robinson. I'm the opinion and community engagement editor for the Columbus Dispatch. And we have one thing in common here for sure. And that thing is that this is our very first Columbus Storytelling Project. So give yourself a round of applause for being first. We're first. We won already, right? Also, some of you might not know what Storytellers is. It's new to Columbus, but it's not a new concept. USA Today Network has been doing storytelling sessions all around the country since 2016. So the speakers you'll hear tonight will join a fraternity, sorority, whatever you want to call it, that is 6,000 people strong. That in itself is pretty awesome. One more clap, right? Yeah, why not? I didn't program one in. The best part about this project, from my point of view, is that our newsroom really worked hard with these storytellers to craft stories and presentations that were important to them. They're going to share stories about who they are, what they do, and why that matters. And like Danae said, you're going to resonate with many of these stories, and some you won't. So you'll learn something new about somebody else. We have some really fantastic people up here who are going to hit on this subject of growing up. So all of us have these stories when we were children of growing up, and we might remember things accurately and not so accurately and all that stuff. You know how it works, right? You fill in the blanks when you get a certain age anyway. So I'm from an age before safety. I'm from the late 70s to the early 90s where, you know, we can go out late in the night, run around with scissors, had to come in when the lights came on, maybe not get abducted, you know, maybe get abducted. That's a bad joke. So it was a rough time. My mother was a sassy pants lady in a lot of ways of the 70s and 80s. One way she wasn't sassy is her choice of cars. She had a horrible station wagon. Now you're thinking, station wagon? That sounds dope. No, it wasn't dope. We're talking 1970s boat-sized, worst green you've ever seen in your life car. And she liked it so much, she kept getting the same model when the other one broke down. So you had the same car over and over and over and over again. And so as a child of the 70s, 80s, you know, no safety, one of my favorite part about these cars was the unsafety aspects of it. The whole thing was metal, of course, you know, just like the sliding boards where we slid down and burned our legs. These cars had the seatbelts where you just clicked them on, and the metal seatbelt, you click it off. The door handle was metal. The little lock was metal. So I would be sitting in the back seat, and I would just like click on, click out, click on, click out, press, 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 click on, click off for like the whole ride, right? My mother would be like, stop, and she would say some words I'm not going to say because I'm a lady. And she would threaten me, but I knew she wasn't going to really do anything because she's driving, right? So anybody from Cleveland here? All right, you ever heard of St. Clair Avenue? Okay, so my house is around the corner from St. Clair Avenue, so we took St. Clair all the time. And St. Clair is a fast, fast street, especially if you're a little kid, right? It's like the Autobahn for little kids, right? So I was doing this, like, click on, click off, blah, 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 and having a great old time in the back seat. And my mother hit a bump. Boop, right? And I was clicking on, clicking off. So I went woof out the car. So, and so I'm spinning and swirling. And I don't know what's happening. And it seemed like an hour and a half had passed. Finally, this lady comes out of the car, my mother, picks me up, puts me back in the car and drags me off. Later, she like wipes the gravel from my butt and everything like that. So that's cool. And so you think, you learned the lesson to listen to your mother, not play with the door. Not me. I'm a journalist. I'm tenacious. You know, I'm going to get the job done. So I fell in another car the same kind of way. And that lesson came to me like the real lesson is the harder the head, the softer the butt, and the more gravel that goes into it. So it carried me through. So we So anyway, so we have some great storytellers tonight. We're going to bring up the very first one. And his story is about marathons, and it's not exactly the way you think it. It's not about running necessarily. So we're going to bring to the stage Chris Sewell. Come on up, Chris.
If you was to ask me 18 years ago, that I think I would be here, I would say never in my wildest dreams. As a kid born and raised on the south side of Columbus, I was raised in a predominantly single parent home to a mother that worked two jobs, still works two jobs today. I'm the oldest of seven kids on both my mom and my dad's side. I met my father when I was 15. Due to his absence, I primarily lived up to two of my grandfathers. One was more spiritual, the other was a cool grandfather. Smooth bald head, well-dressed, mannerisms, pedicure feet, manicure hands. As you can see, his appearance was everything, and I learned a lot of the stuff from him. Growing up on the South Side for me was everything. My friends were on that side of town. I had family across the bridge, and it was a community. And as a kid, to me, some of the stuff that I saw was normal. Police sirens were normal. Gunshots were normal. Seeing drugs was normal. seeing weapons was normal. Proud Columbus City School graduate, Eastmore Academy, 2004. And going into my senior year, or pretty much my high school career, I was a mediocre student. Heading into my senior year, all I cared about was girls, getting fly, and playing basketball. And heading into the summer, I had got denied to every college that I had applied to. And I had no idea what I was going to do after I graduated high school. And at this time, I started hanging with new friends. So we were doing, a week after I graduated, I was hanging out with my new friends, and we decided to go to Walmart. We go to Walmart. I wanted to buy a weapon. I told y'all growing up, I had seen them. I had held them, but I had never had my own weapon. So I decided to buy an airsoft pistol. Keep in mind, my mom worked two jobs, so she honestly didn't know what I was doing, but I was old enough to still do what I wanted to do. So I bought the weapon. And holding that weapon made me feel special. And so when I got home, what I did was, if you ever seen an airsoft weapon, the tip is orange. I got home, I painted the tip black. I painted the tip of this weapon, the now that I consider the gun, black. The same friends who I've been hanging with, or just recently started hanging with, have been committing crimes throughout my high school career, and I didn't know. But I knew they was getting money, but I never knew how they got money. And so they called me one day after they graduate to go celebrate, like, ride with us right quick. We're about to go hit a lick. But bring that gun with you. So I bring it. They commit the crime. And as I'm sitting in the car, as the crime is being committed, I look back out the window, and I see him running out with a bag full of money. And I mean, he's running in slow motion. Money flying everywhere. And in my mind, I'm thinking, what did I just get myself into? We go back to the house. I take the weapon back, put it in my car. And as I get ready to say goodbye, police pull up. They arrest me. I sit in jail for like a week or two. And I get out of jail, and there's a letter waiting on me from Wright State University. Had no idea where Wright State University was. Never visited, never seen it. Didn't even know what a Raider was. That was our mascot. And so I open it, and then I'm thinking, another denial letter on top of a pending trial that I'm going through. I get the letter, I'm accepted to Wright State. And honestly, until 2 years ago, my mom finally told me that she had applied for me. She had applied for me. I'm like, where did you apply this at? And so I immediately accepted yes. No idea how I was going to get there, but I said, you know what? Let's go to Wright State. And keep it. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I still got to go to court to think about this trial that I get that for this crime that was committed. I end up going to trial. I get 3 years probation. Other guys were attending to jail time. Those 3 years probation felt like I was doing jail time too. And if you know anything about being a convicted felon or people that are convicted felons, that road is hard. And so I go to college. I get in trouble again in college, receiving stolen property. So here I am with a felony and a misdemeanor. No idea what I'm going to do. And I'm on probation. I graduate college. And once I graduate college, I can't get a job. Keep in mind, I graduated college with 2 degrees. And so in this lifespan of me getting convicted of a felon, getting a misdemeanor, graduating college, that still wasn't good enough for society and for those running organizations that I wanted to get a job. So in the meantime, to keep funds, I'm a janitor. I'm a custodian. I wash dishes. I'm a busboy. I'm a busboy with 2 degrees working at Max and Irma's in German Village. Working in warehouses, I immediately get depressed. Because at this time, my mom was giving me $100 a week. I'm driving her car. I'm living in her house. I'm taking $100, going to the casino, gambling $100 away, and losing it just because I wanted more money. I immediately go into a depression, and I'm getting ready to commit suicide. So I call my mom. Mom, I don't want to live no more. She immediately starts crying hysterically. She then calls my grandfather, the one, remember I told y'all earlier, was so cool, calm, and collective. He then calls me and said, boy, what the hell is wrong with you? Literally just like that. And I'm just like, I can't get a job. I ain't got no money. He said, you were to fix that shit. I call my mom back. I rethink about what I just said. And I apologize, not knowing that my siblings look up to me She asks me, who's going to walk your sister down the aisle when she gets ready to get married? Who's going to help raise her brother who's younger? So I changed the trajectory of my life. Fast forward to 2010, laws have changed. I get my record expunged. I also had applied for a pardon through Kasich, Governor Kasich at the time. The same day that I got my pardon letter denying my pardon, the same day that I got my record expunged in Franklin County. That one thing changed my life. I got my record expunged at 28. From 18 to 28, I was a convicted felon. Got my record expunged. Started applying for jobs. Got my first job at Franklin County Children's Service as a caseworker. Went on then to get a new job at Franklin County Job and Family Services. I joined the military at 30. Deployed to Iraq, Syria, and Kuwait. Got a job at City of Columbus as a neighborhood program specialist. Interviewed while I was in Iraq for a job with the city as a program manager for MBK. And now I work in the mayor's office. I worked hard to get here, goddamn hard to get here. And one of the reasons I call my story the marathon is because I didn't quit. I had every opportunity to quit. And the road to get here was hard. And I'm not going to stop. The journey is just beginning, so the marathon continues.
Wow, Chris, thank you so much for sharing such an inspiring story. Now I'd like to introduce our second storyteller, Ramona Reyes, who's going to tell a story titled Hidden Heroes about the mentors who helped her.
I'm the eighth child, born on the eighth day, on the eighth month. The number eight has a lot of significance in my life. A lot of its characteristics remind me of my grandmother, my namesake. My grandmother had these big gray curls, beautiful smile, dazzling gray eyes. But she wore these matching polyester clothes, blue shirt with blue pants, brown shirt with brown. If it had a pattern, they also matched. We said my grandmother invented garanimals. She was a migrant worker and dropped out of school at an early age. She learned how to read and write English using the Bible. She taught me Spanish using the Bible. Came in handy later in life. She worked way into her 80s as a senior companion, working in a nursing home. She'd always giggle and say, "I am helping people younger than me." She volunteered. I would say I learned my faith, my work ethic, and my volunteerism from her. She was my mentor. So I was eighth. That's a significant number. But I was also first in many things, especially in my education. I'm a child of migrant farm working family. We would travel from a little town in South Texas near the Mexican border, all throughout the United States, picking fresh fruits and vegetables. My parents would make probably about $15,000 a year to raise a family of 11. But I didn't feel poor. When school started, I had brand new clothes. And my mother would start buying us clothes for the following year, figuring out how much we would grow. In the back of the house, it was this closet, and you could see the blue jeans piling up, the t-shirts, the six-pack of tube socks, the school supplies. School was very important in my family. My mother wanted to make sure that none of us worked in the fields when we grew up. See, my mom dropped out in second grade and never learned how to read or write. She'd always say, No seas burra como yo. Don't be a dummy like me. My mom was no dummy. She would display her pride. When you walked into our living room, there was these 11 by 14 pictures of all my siblings in their high school cap and gown. And I couldn't wait to be on that wall. I also knew I did not want to be a migrant worker. Working out in the hot sun the very first time, even though I didn't pick very often, all it took was picking up that first nasty tomato out there in the field and said, oh my God, this is not something I want to do the rest of my life. So I knew I had challenges and we were poor, so I had to do everything I could to make sure that I got a scholarship somewhere. My junior year, Dr. Jose Villa and several recruiters from The Ohio State University came down to South Texas and tried to convince my parents that it's okay that your little daughter travels 1,500 miles away from your house all the way to this place out there in Columbus, Ohio, and go to school. Well, a little tug and war and making sure that I got the grades, I got accepted at Ohio State University, and I was awarded the Campbell Soup Scholarship for migrant students that would travel to Ohio every year. I was so excited. And it included a trip home to ensure that we didn't get homesick. Yeah. So here I go, and I land in the shores of the Olentangy River. The very first time that I was around people that didn't look like me, didn't act like me, didn't talk like me, because in South Texas, 85% Mexican American. So it was a little bit of a culture shock for me. Then my grades started to slip, and I was in risk of losing my scholarship. Now, Dr. Villa had promised my family that he would take care of me, that he would ensure that I was going to be successful. And he wrapped all these resources around me, including Dr. Stephen Hill, two very important people in my life that continue to be in my life today. And they said, Ramona, how would you feel if you had to pack everything up and go home and tell your parents you failed? I said, that's not something I want to do. So I made sure I turned around, and I was getting ready to graduate at The Ohio State University. And my parents made the 23-hour trip to come to my graduation. And my dad said, I'm going to be in full Mexican garb with a big sombrero so you can see me. And I'm like, oh my God, I hope not. But as I walked into The Ohio State University Stadium on a sunny, bright day, tens of thousands of people in that stadium, and I looked around, and I'm looking, I'm like, there's no way I'm going to see my parents. But as I looked up, the B deck stands, there's my father. And he's waving his white Texas-sized cowboy hat so that I knew that they were there. That very moment, I'm like, wow, we did it. We made it. And the two most important people in my life were in the stadium. And all that hard work that they had gone through lived through me. My lived experience in having that degree at Ohio State University gave me a very successful work career. I was inspired as being the first-generation college graduate, the first Latina elected official in the city of Columbus, the first in my family to survive breast cancer, But now it was my turn to give back. So I developed the Ramona Reyes Foundation, named after my grandmother, so that I could create a scholarship to give back to people just like me. And that occurred because I have very important people in my life. My grandmother, my first mentor, my mother, my mentor, my father, my mentor, Dr. Jose Villa, my mentor, Dr. Stephen Hill, Alejandro Rodriguez, Richard Gandarillas, and I can go on and on and on and on and on. I was first in many aspects of my life, but with the work I do now, I know I will not be the last.
Wow, that was great, Ramona. Thank you so much for sharing your inspiring story. It was so great to hear how your family helped you and you were able to translate that into helping other people now. Before I introduce our next teller, I'd like to take a moment to thank and recognize the people who made this night possible. What's different about the Storytellers Project is that the newsrooms that host it use their journalists to help coach tellers and work with people from the community to craft their stories for maximum impact. So we had four journalists from our newsroom work with these tellers, and I'd like them to stand up and be recognized. They are Kaylee Doyle, Sheridan Hendricks, Ryan Smith, and Holly Zachariah. We thank them so much for their dedication and time. I'd also really like to thank our tellers tonight, who, as you can tell, have volunteered to spend several of their hours working on crafting these stories for you. We could not put on this event without their dedication and commitment to what they're doing. So thank you as well to our tellers. Now I'd like to introduce our next storyteller, Mallory Golsky. She's going to tell a story titled, It Turns Out I'm Gay, about a personal discovery she made with the help of a friend.
You're not supposed to ask someone if they're gay. Like any empathetic person with any ounce of respect for others, you're supposed to let that person grow comfortable enough with themselves and you to finally feel comfortable to come out. So one night, well, or you know, you could also take the more Zuckerbergian approach, and you can creep through a person's entire internet presence and decide, based on one post from a pride they attended in 2017, and another declaring that Tegan and Sarah are their favorite singers, that she might have a thing for women. So one night in college, I went to my friend's apartment to express my frustrations for the millionth time about my disdain for Tinder and my friend's seemingly never-ending conversations about the hot guys they swiped on. And she responded to me by asking, well, if you don't like looking at pictures of hot guys, well, what about women? Do you ever find women especially alluring? Do you ever find yourself so tongue-tied when you're trying to talk to a woman and you can't figure out why? I didn't really think she was asking me if I was gay. I responded obviously, as if she had just asked if I liked ice cream or if I found calculus impossible. Well, yeah, but doesn't everybody? No, she said. I had gone to my friend's apartment for a mental reprieve, not to face a life-altering inquisition. You're not supposed to ask people if they're gay, I said to myself. You're supposed to ask yourself if you're gay. And that's exactly what I did that night while lying on my back on my twin-sized mattress. For dramatic effect, I would say that I was staring up at the ceiling, but in reality, I was experiencing flashback after flashback of every moment of my life leading up to that point. And with each memory, I thought to myself, holy shit. I think I might be gay. That was the first night in my 21 years of existence that it ever even crossed my mind that I might be gay. It's not that I didn't support queer people. I had lots of queer friends. I have gay uncles. I had taken a queer theory class in college, and I had attended Pride in San Francisco, of all places. And while I was there, I attended the Dyke March, waving a flag, watching the women walk by and thinking, oh my gosh, they are so cool. I want to be just like them. But I had never associated the words with myself. I had dated lots of guys, like the one guy who I dated for 2 whole months in the 8th grade. We had held hands for about 5 minutes at a football game. We exchanged hundreds of text messages, but we didn't know the first thing to say to each other in person. It was awkward and miserable, sure, but aren't all middle school relationships? There were other guys, too, and theoretically, they were wonderful. They loved to read, they longed to travel, and they were passionate about fixing the perils of the world, just like I was. But when it came down to it, I would always come up with an excuse as to why he couldn't possibly be the one. I was just too busy. I was too focused on school and extracurriculars. Their hands were just a little bit too rough for me to hold. Their stubble on their chin was just too scratchy for me to want to kiss. But at the end of the day, I just couldn't stand the constant debilitating anxiety I felt every time that I was dating a guy. I accepted bouquets of flowers like death sentences. I dreaded hanging out in the inevitable moment when he would turn on Netflix and start to kiss me. To this day, I can't watch The Office or Parks and Rec because the theme songs still make my chest start to tighten at the memory. I always liked to hang out in public places because it minimized the opportunity for us to kiss or hold hands. And every time before the dates, I'd try to hype myself up like, okay, Mallory, you got this. The next time he tries to kiss you, it's not going to be so bad. You're going to enjoy it. You're going to have fun like everybody else. Like everyone else says it's fun to kiss guys. You two are going to have fun. I just had to relax and stop thinking. But that night, I couldn't stop thinking, especially about the other question my friend had asked me. Well, don't you just think it's fun to swipe through and look at pictures of hot guys? No. No, it wasn't. In fact, I couldn't think of anything more boring, and I could never understand why such a huge swath of the population just participated in this little game where they obsessed over the appearances of men. Or, worse yet, when they actually decided to date one. Ever since middle school, I had always felt profoundly left out whenever the topic of boys came up, because I never really knew what to contribute to the conversation. Don't get me wrong, I knew how to describe the appearance of a conventionally attractive guy. When somebody would point out a guy and say, oh, isn't he so cute? I had read enough 17 magazines to fake it till I make it. I could say, oh yes, he has great hair. Oh wow, he is so hot. He has great abs. I had read American Girl's A Smart Girl's Guide to Boys cover to cover more times than I'd like to admit. I knew how to describe the feeling of having a crush, and I tried to do so, but it never felt genuine. I tried to talk to my friends about this and explain, I just don't understand, I just am not into guys, whatever. And they never quite understood, so I stopped talking about it, really. Because there comes a time when it's no longer socially acceptable, when the lights go out at the sleepovers and your friend asks, oh, who do you have a crush on? What guy do you like? To go, ugh, boys have cooties. Or worse yet, when your family members ask, do you have a boyfriend yet? To say, yes, I have a boyfriend, but every time we hang out, I just get so anxious that I want to lock myself in a room all by myself. Or yes, I have a boyfriend, but the one time he tried to make out with me, it was so terrible that I kicked him out of the house and I sobbed in the basement by myself for hours. Why didn't anybody tell me that kissing a boy was so disgusting? Why didn't anybody tell me that making out with a boy felt like a soggy vacuum cleaner attacking your face? Why would anybody voluntarily do this? Why would anyone say that this is fun? So after a while, I'd break up with the boy using the tried and true phrase, it's not you, it's me. And then I would feel terrible because that was often the only time that I had really been genuine with him. Like, no, you don't understand. It's not you. You're wonderful. It's me. There's just something so horribly wrong with me. Something so wrong because I just feel repulsed at the idea of dating you. I'm sorry, but you deserve to be with someone normal. Someone who doesn't have a literal panic attack at the thought of holding your hand. And over time, I just became so fixated on whatever could possibly be wrong with me because I didn't like boys that I didn't even let myself consider the possibility or the realization that I was entirely obsessed with women. Like the girl in my fifth grade class who had gorgeous hair. Or the college swimmer who coached my lane at swim camp that I attended in high school, who I just really wanted to impress. I would touch the wall and she'd say, "Great job." And I'd say, "Me? You thought I did a great job? Wow." And then all of my teammates who, you know, there were so many of them that I just really wanted to be friends with, and I would just get so tongue-tied and I just really wanted to impress them, but I had such a hard time even holding a conversation because I was so tongue-tied and had so many nervous butterflies. But I didn't think anything of it. I just thought that's what happened to everybody when you really wanted to be friends with someone. I didn't think I was actually, that could mean I was gay. Until that night. Okay, so I don't really like boys, and I do act kind of differently when I'm around women. But how do I know if I'm actually gay? I did what any self-actualized person would do. I turned to Google. And it turns out the questions, "Am I gay?" and "How do I know I'm a lesbian?" are pretty common Google searches. And luckily, we live in the era of BuzzFeed quizzes. I figured I would take a few, average my scores, and have a definitive answer about my sexuality. But after reading the first paragraph of the first article that I turned to, I had my answer pretty quickly. If you went out of the way to ask the internet if you're gay, you're probably gay. You can learn a lot about yourself on the internet. I am an ENFJ on the Myers-Briggs scale. I'm an Enneagram type 3. And turns out, I'm gay. I'd like to say that I came to my realization and everything, you know, all tied up neatly that night. But in reality, it took months of thinking and processing before I could even write it in my journal, let alone say it out loud to a friend, or an entire audience of people, for that matter. But today, I am out, and I am happy, and in fact, I never feel that, you know, crazy anxiety that I always felt every time somebody would talk about boys in front of me. In fact, I feel so happy that I do a happy dance because I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't have to marry a man. This is so great. Every time. Never gets old. There are some days when I want to look at my former self and shake her and say, "Mallory, you idiot, read your journals. Listen to yourself. You're so obviously gay." But most of the time, I just want to give my former self a hug and say, "Mallory, it's okay. You're not a loser. There's nothing wrong with you. You just don't like boys, and that's okay, because you are not the only person who feels this way. In fact, there's an entire queer community out there who will wrap their arms around you and welcome you into their family and help you embrace and celebrate the parts of you that have always been there. And that includes my loving girlfriend, Madeline." But mostly, while I'm grateful for that community, I am so grateful for my friend who helped me come to that realization that night. Because while you're not supposed to ask people if they're gay, I'm pretty glad that she asked me.
Thank you so much, Mallory. That story was great, and I really appreciate how you really brought home the fact that men should watch the cooties off their hands. And TV is bad, and TV news must be worse, and everybody should subscribe to The Dispatch at dispatch.com/subscribe now. So I'm so happy to welcome our next speaker up to the stage. We have James Foucault, who is going to speak on the neighborhood that raised him.
I tell you what, Amelia, if the Dispatch doesn't work out, you should really go to the Funny Bone. They may have a spot for you. That's excellent. And also, my mother was a lot like yours, so we might be distant cousins because I was a little hard-headed to have that soft tushy, but we know that's not what they really said to us, so we're going to clean it up and keep it PG. So again, thanks to my brother Chris for being the first. Give him a round of applause for being the first. Excellent, excellent story. Just a quick story I want to talk about, Chris. We are both from the South Side, and that's what I'm going to talk about, of Columbus. So any Bulldogs in the house? Any Bulldog graduates? There's always one. Always one. Proud Bulldog. Oh, there's two? Okay. Class of 1997, so I'm a little bit younger-ish, but no. Chris and I go way back. He's a phenomenal, phenomenal man who has really done a great job in being a true example of how you can correct your wrongs and be just an incredible person. And for Ramona, I was so hoping at graduation that your dad was going to be waving a sombrero and not the Texas hat. I was just so waiting for the payoff on that, but excellent. And I thank you for everything that you do. And Mallory, yes, us boys, we do kiss like a wet, soggy vacuum. So, I mean, I don't know what else I could say. That's just what we do. So, that's just, can't help it. You're right. I mean, I like kissing girls too, so it's okay. So anyhow, for those of you who do not know me, my name is James Fuqua. I have the privilege of being the public information officer, fancy word for spokesperson for the Columbus Police Department. I've been serving proudly for 17 years, and it's very unique because I typically never tell my story, so I'm definitely very honored to tell a little bit about my story tonight. Most times when people see me, obviously, I actually communicate with Danae and Holly, who will be closing us out very regularly, that it's always negative stuff. So this is just a little peek behind me personally that I can actually separate myself from my job for once. So like I said, I'm a proud, born and raised Columbus native, South Side. And growing up on the South Side, I had two different lives. First, I grew up in German Village. Life was good, had a mother and father in the home, everything was great. But unfortunately, my father had a lot of mental health issues, and we're talking the early 90s when, specifically in the Black community, still today, to be quite honest, mental health issues are really not addressed like they should be. And unfortunately, at the age of 12, my father committed suicide. So I was left with, I'm the oldest of four siblings, and because of that, we had to move to the other South Side. So we went from, as you know, west of Parsons to the east of Parsons, which I don't know if you know, but when it gets a little dark, when you're going down Whittier and you're not in German Village anymore, it's not the same South Side. But needless to say, we had to move over there. And the thing that really struck me, now, I was a very soft kid. Like I said, I had a very privileged life prior to my father's passing, but once he passed away, unfortunately, my mom had to work multiple jobs as a single parent, and I was the oldest of the siblings, so I took a lot of pride in trying to do whatever I could, odd jobs, cutting grass, washing cars, whatever I could do to help my mother and my siblings survive. So, as you know, in the early 90s, it was very, very rough. Chris talked a little bit about it in his story. A lot of gangs, a lot of violence, drive-by shootings, prostitution, drugs, all these things. It was just a challenge to walk from the house to the corner store and back. And I often talk about I'm truly a statistical miracle because by the age of 16, I had been shot, stabbed, and robbed at gunpoint, all separate incidents, all within 1 mile radius of my house. So, yeah, it was pretty rough. No, no, don't be sad. I'm still here. I'm still here. It's all good. I promise. It's all good. But I tried so hard to stay out of the negative things within the neighborhood. But unfortunately, just like Chris said, there are a lot of influences that come about. And like I said, my mom didn't have a lot of money. And we literally, for any of you who have ever had real struggle in the wintertime, there was a lot of opening that oven and just letting that heat permeate through the house because we just didn't have heat to go on. So not only not having a lot of money, but I didn't have the best clothes either. And most of my friends were either in a gang or sold drugs. So I desperately, desperately wanted to help my mom. But here's the thing about growing up. It's so important to me where I came from, and I'm so thankful, even though I know a lot of my friends participated in a lot of illegal activities and a lot of bad things. We'll kind of circle back to that shortly. So I just wanted a new pair of Air Jordans. That's all I wanted. I wanted a new pair of Air Jordans, and I wanted to help my mom turn the lights back on. So like I said, a lot of my friends were drug dealers and gang members, and I said, please, 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 just let me sell some drugs. I don't care what kind of drugs they are. Just, I know you guys make a lot of money. Just give me something. I watch y'all stand in front of the corner store. Can't be that hard. So they're like, okay. So one of them said, okay, I tell you what, we'll give you just a little bag of marijuana. If you can just go to that corner store and wait for this guy and you sell this bag of marijuana, we'll give you money so you can do your thing. Now, for a lot of you, you may not know there are a code in the streets. And my neighborhood knew that I was different. They knew that I wasn't a bad kid. I really didn't have the DNA to be a gang member or a drug dealer. But I took that bag of marijuana because I really wanted those Air Jordans. So I run to the corner store. I'm like, oh, this is easy. So I post up, put my foot on the wall, have my hands out, trying to look like a drug dealer. And within 2 minutes, a police cruiser comes down Whittier. I'll never forget. They probably didn't even really look at me, but I stared that cruiser all the way down. My eyes got this big, and I ran back to my friend's house, and I threw the bag of marijuana at him, and I said, this is stupid. I can't do it. And by this point, some of my other friends were there, and they were all waiting for me to come back because they knew I wouldn't do it, and they were dying laughing. And the best part of the story is, oh, no one was really ever going to buy from me because it was a bag of oregano and not even real marijuana. Yeah. So my point is, even the streets have a code. So a lot of times, like I said, growing up, I wasn't a fan of the police. No one really that looked like me in my neighborhood were fans of the police. So usually when they would ride by, I would give them the one finger salute. And I think we know which finger that was to show my appreciation or lack thereof for police. Didn't really like them, didn't trust them. And really never did anything other than try to be a 4-minute drug dealer. That didn't go very well. And I'll never forget. This was the number one moment that made me distrust police, and I said, I will never deal with them ever. We got out of school early. We had an electrical issue, so we were super excited. It was a warm spring day. We go home. Me and my buddy were sitting on my porch, 1153 Wilson Avenue, where I lived, and we're just sitting on the porch minding our own business, and the police helicopter was flying around, which was kind of odd. Normally, it was only at night, but it was flying early in the day. And for anybody who knew in that era, we refused to call the police helicopter that. We called it the ghetto bird. So if you never heard of that, the ghetto bird was the nastiest thing that we wanted no part of, right? So the ghetto bird is just swarming, and they're getting lower, and it's getting louder, and I can't figure out why. It looked like the pilot was looking directly at me, and it was warm. And anybody that knows anything about helicopters, they used to take the doors off of the police helicopters when it was warm. So they were circling, and I remember him pointing at me. So I pointed back with that one finger salute that I often did when the police cruisers came by. And I was like, yeah, whatever. So I sat back on the porch. Within 30 seconds, a swarm of police cruisers came up. They snatched us off the porch, me and my friend, and he slammed my face down into the mud. And he put that shotgun on the back of my neck, and he cocked it. And all I could feel was that cold, hard steel, that metal just pressed on the back of my neck. And I honestly could not figure out why this happened. And he said, if you move, he would kill me. So I laid there. Next thing you know, I'm in handcuffs. I'm in the back of the car. And these same drug dealer friends, the real gang members and drug dealers, are staring at me. And they're trying to tell the cops, like, let him go. He's a good one. He doesn't cause any problems. They had me in the back of the car, and the only thing they would tell me was that I broke into a house and just burglarized it when I literally just walked home from school. So I'm in disbelief. I'm in the back of this cop car, can't believe how I got here, and I start crying because, like I told you, I'm soft now. So I'm crying, and I'm thinking, I wasn't a big guy. I was like, I'm going to go to jail. They're going to drop the soap, and I'm just my butt. I can't make it. Like, this is what I'm thinking. I can't make this up. So I'm like, oh, I can't drop the soap. Don't drop the soap. So now we're driving down the street, and I'm going to juvie jail. And as we're driving off, my house got smaller and smaller, and the tears got bigger and bigger. And as we were going downtown, I'll never forget, on the police radio, they said, he's code 4. For anybody now being the police, I know code 4 means no action. He didn't do it. He's innocent. They brought me back home. Thankfully, the one neighbor at the end of the street said it absolutely was not him, and they ended up catching the perpetrators later. So thankfully, they let me go. But I had a lot of disdain for police after that and a lot of resentment, and I was just trying to figure out my life. So fast forward now. I graduate high school. Well, prior to graduating high school, I was a really good athlete, and again, these same drug dealers and gang members, they always kept me out of trouble, and it was so important to them, and they always would tell me, you're different, you're going to make it, whatever you do in life, you're going to be very successful, we don't want you to be like us. So they always, always encouraged me to be that, and I always, always had that in the back of my mind, never knowing exactly what I was going to do, but the fact that these guys that engage in the behavior and activity that they do thought so highly of me really meant something. So I graduated high school, went to the United States Army, did that for a couple years. I got out, wasn't really sure what I was going to do. Had a part-time job at a retail store, met an officer who was working off-duty or special duty at the store. His name is Alan Blackman. He just retired last year after 32 years of service. Great, great man. He said, hey, I think you would be a really good officer. And I said, heck nah, not me. And he said, no, you should do a ride-along. And I said, no, I've been in the back of cop cars, bro. I'm good. I'm not doing that again. And he said, no, you ride in the front seat. And I'm like, I didn't even know that was a thing. So I was like, okay, I'll try it out, because he kept hounding me. Every day he saw me for like a month straight. So I do the ride-along. I did the night shift in the same neighborhood that I actually grew up in. And from day one, I was hooked that night. Just seeing how the officers interacted and these groups were so cool and how they did things. And I said, hey, man, where were y'all at when I used to get picked up for no reason? And they're like, I don't know. But the point is, I recognized from the other side that these officers were risking their lives for people they didn't even know, risking their lives, putting all of it out on the table, and they did so much for people while they slept and had no idea the amount of things that they did. And that night it was cool. It was like an episode of Cops. Like, we got in a foot chase and there was a stolen car and there was all the things. Now I know that happens very rarely, but at the time that was like the best night of my life. And so I said, okay, I'm going to do it. So fast forward, I go through the process. I get the job. I'm super thankful. But the most important thing to me was going back to the same neighborhood that I grew up. And not only did I do that, but I did it for 10 years straight without leaving the exact beat of the neighborhood I walked through every single day. And why that was important to me, because specifically little black and brown kids, when they would see the police when we were growing up at their age, there was always fear. There was always misunderstanding and not understanding or knowing why officers do what they do. So I made it a point to always get out and talk and walk the beat, literally walk the beat and get to know every single person. So specifically the young people could understand that not all police are bad, and we actually work really, really hard to make everyone safe. And if you do the right things and you keep on the straight and narrow, you'll be just fine. So thankfully, that is a great thing for me. After all of these years, one of the other funny stories that I remember during my field training was being in that same neighborhood that I grew up in. And we're sitting there, and when you're out in field training, you have your coach, and then you're just driving. And I'll never forget hearing three gunshots back to back to back, like three blocks from where I live, and I just sat at the stop sign. And my coach looked at me like, you gonna do something about that? And I said, I'm the police now. I don't have to run away. I have to run to it. So I run to the car, end up actually catching the person that was firing off the shots, and I realized even when I was capturing someone doing something very bad and very dangerous, the fear that he had in his eyes, he really thought that I was going to unnecessarily use force. And the fact that I was able to take him into custody safely and talk him through everything, and we had a long conversation that night after the shots, and he was just shooting off shots, not a bad kid just because he had got a gun from his friend. And my point in that specific story, why that is so important to me, is after we had that conversation, now he still had to go to jail, but after that, he still went to jail. After that conversation, that young man, I didn't see again, never thought anything about it, and I literally saw him 6 years later, and he had told me that was the best thing that ever happened to him, and that turned him around, and he is a very successful businessman in the city of Columbus as we speak. So my point to all of my story is, if I can make it out and I loved where I came from and the people that I surrounded myself with, good or bad, that anybody can make it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, James. It was really inspiring to hear your story about your neighborhood and how you went back to it for so long as well. I too agree that Amelia could definitely be on a comedy tour right now, so I'm glad she's emceeing with us instead. Before I introduce our final teller, I wanted to let you all know that on your way out, the first 80 subscribers to the Columbus Dispatch and dispatch.com are going to get a free brownie from Fairy Tale Brownies. So Fairy Tale Brownies, it has been supporting the Storytellers Project nearly since it began 10 years ago in Phoenix. And they believe what we believe, that it's through stories, whether fairy tales, myths, or family legends, that we communicate our values. And they believe that every story is better with a sweet ending. So I have to tell you, you can get your own at brownies.com as well. Thanks for entertaining my little advertisement. So now it is my great pleasure to introduce our fifth and final storyteller, and it's Holly Zachariah. She's been a reporter for more than 30 years, and she spent a lot of those at the Dispatch, and I know she's made a big impact on all of us during that time. So please welcome Holly to the stage.
I don't remember exactly where I was when I first heard the sound, but the tiny little apartment that I grew up in Kenton, in Hardin County in Northwest Ohio, was only a few hundred square feet, so I didn't have very many choices. I was probably in the kitchen or maybe in the bathroom when I heard it, and it was this thwack, thwack, thwack. So I took my little 8-year-old self around the corner into the living room, and there she was, my mom, on her knees, in the middle of that threadbare, green 70s carpet. The living room was dark, fake paneling on the walls covered from her cigarette smoke. It was dark because we always kept the curtains closed so that if a bill collector came, they wouldn't know we were home. And in my mom's hand, she clutched a ball-peen hammer. In front of her, there were these three little wooden circles, souvenirs. And inside each one was an Eisenhower silver dollar. Thwack, thwack, thwack. My mom was busting them out. I didn't really know why, but I could guess. Because we were hungry. And my brother, who was 10 years older than me, and my mom and I had to eat. Now, I don't remember everything about that day, but I remember the room just became a tunnel. And all I could see was my mom there on her knees. And I channeled and summoned so much rage. More rage than an 8-year-old girl should ever be able to summon. And I don't remember exactly what I said to Mom, but I remember it was awful. And I screamed at her and I clawed at her back. I said, "Why do we have to live like this? Why do we have to be poor? Why do I go to school and the kids make fun of my clothes? Why do the teachers ask me if I need a bar of soap to take to the bathroom with me?" But I do remember this, because then came the dagger. I do remember saying, "Why did I have to be born to you?" And my mom just let me rage, and she picked up the three silver dollars, and cleaned up the floor, and she went and got her raincoat, the same one she always wore, whether it was raining or not, and tied it around her belt, or tied the belt around her waist, told my brother and I goodbye, and she walked out the door. We didn't have a car. We were fortunate that the corner store was only a couple blocks away. We knew where she was going. She was going to get some food. She probably wasn't gone 15 minutes. She walked back in the door, clutching one paper bag. She walks into our kitchen. Again, that 70s Formica metal kitchen table that we all had in our homes. Mismatched chairs, metal and vinyl seats. And she sets that bag down on the table. She pulled out the same stuff she always did, probably a half a gallon of milk, a loaf of bread, pound and a half or two of chip-chopped ham. We didn't even like it. We liked bologna. But bologna's expensive, and it's only good when it's thick. And so the ham went so much farther when it was chipped. And then my mom reached down inside that paper bag, and she pulled out a single Hostess apple pie. They were my favorite. I didn't like the apples. They were gross. So I usually either picked them all out and gave them to my brother or threw them in the garbage. But man, whenever I got that treat, it was just that cinnamon sugar goo in the center and that thick dough with just a little bit of sugar on the outside. My mom handed it to me. And we went on about our day. Now the next morning, I remember getting up. And here's something you should know about my mom. Her name was Pauline. And my mom used to say, "Every time that you do a good deed here on earth, God puts a knickknack on your wall in heaven to prepare a spot for you." Because my mom never met a knickknack she didn't like. So above her chair in the living room, there was a shelf that I still have in my basement. And all these little tchotchkes were all over it. And I remember the next morning I noticed that her collection of little ceramic horses had been moved because the spot where those three silver dollars had stayed my whole life had been rearranged and the shelf had been dusted, and every trace of that day was gone. And we never spoke about it again till some 13 and a half years later. I'd been gone from home quite a while at that point. Our relationship had changed. My mom was my best friend. I saw her every day, talked to her multiple times a day. And I stopped in one afternoon, same as I often did. Mom had a pot of coffee on, same as she always did. And we went to that same kitchen table, that same Formica table, with those same mismatched chairs. And I said, I've got something I want to say to you today. I said, I want to talk about those three silver dollars that you busted out of their casements on our living room floor. And my mom had these beautiful, big, brown doe eyes. And they got wide, glistened with tears, and she said, what? All that we've been through, all that we did, that's what you remember? Those three silver dollars? And she started to cry. And I said, yes, that's what I remember, Mom. Because the weight that I have carried my whole life, the anger and the bitterness and the rage about growing up poor was like this wet wool blanket on my shoulders, weighing me down. And that moment of you on your knees clutching a ball-peen hammer, that was it. I couldn't get that image out of my mind. But I said, Mom, that's not what I want to say to you today. What I want to say to you today is I get it. We weren't poor because you didn't work hard enough. And we weren't poor because you didn't do enough. And we weren't poor because you didn't love us enough. And that's what I wanted to say to you today. And she dropped her head down onto that table, and we cried. A few years later, I'm 24, unmarried, and I find myself pregnant. And I'm poor. I'm working three jobs. I'm trying to make a go of it. And I'm terrified. So I did what I always did. And I went back home. And I walked into that kitchen. And my mom and my brother and I sat at that same Formica table on those same mismatched chairs. And I told my mom that I was pregnant. And I cried. And her face lit up like it never had before. And she looked at me and she said, you're going to have a baby. You get to be a mom. I had my baby boy, Justin. And every time I held him, so often I'd look down in his face. His eyes are just like my mom's, big and brown. And I'd look into his eyes. And so often I'd sit there just like my mom did. And I'd think, I've got $10. Do I buy food or do I buy diapers? And it was then, as I was looking into my son's face and my son's eyes, that I would still so often go back to that day. To that moment in that crappy little apartment in Northwest Ohio. And I would still see my mom on her knees. But after I had my baby, I knew that the lessons I carried with me from that day were not about being poor. And I knew the lessons I carried with me from that day were not about growing up in poverty. I knew without a doubt the lessons I carried with me that day, from that day, were about the power of a mother's love.
So much, Holly, for sharing a little piece of Pauline with us. I know it made so many people in here think about their own moms. I certainly am going to call Annie Pearl Robinson and tell her that I'm sorry about all the horrible things I did as a child. And she'll say, okay, and that'll be. So that's it, folks. I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. I especially want to give some shout outs to Miss Danae King for setting this whole thing up and carousing all these journalists and speakers. I want to thank these storytellers for sharing a bit of their souls with us tonight. Thank you so much for being so honest and true to your own self so that we can learn from you. If you're not already a subscriber to the Dispatch, please consider doing so. You can find out more information at dispatch.com/subscribe now. You can like us on all the socials, Facebook, the TikTok, the YouTube, Twitter. Name some more. I don't know. We're on all the socials, so find us there. Also, we're going to be sending out a survey. That's where you can tell us what you think about what happened today. We want to get better, and we want to hear from you guys just generally anyway. Be assure the people, if you brought somebody, please like bring, you know, them that, you know, internet email thing and share it with them so they can also share the technology. I don't know anything. Yes, I do actually. So anyway, we hope you have a fantastic evening, and hopefully we'll see you next time.